I have never heard a sermon about what I'm going to talk about today. And for that matter, I've never preached one. Boy, so are you in for a doozy. In chapter 17 of the Screwtape Letters, C.S. Lewis's famous imaginary story of a conversation between two demons. One demon writes to the other, one of the great achievements of the last 100 years has been to deaden the conscience of all humans on this subject, such that they have not heard a sermon preached, nor has a conscience been burdened in the whole and length of the breadth of England. And that was written back in the 40s. And I dare say that what was true then is probably even more so true now. What we're talking about today is the vice that's come to be known as gluttony. Because that vice, like all other vices, is promising life when in fact it's only stealing it. And so if I might hearken to your memories from a few weeks ago about what was that picture on the front of your bulletin about that beetle that was being consumed by a tree frog, but what is actually happening is that tree frog is being consumed by the beetle. There is a consuming that is being consumed. And that is what the heart of gluttony is. However, like we've come to discover about listening to all of these vices, your first impression about what the vice is never really the fullness thereof. That there are nuances and multiple and myriad versions of this vice, such that it applies to a far wider constituency than you might be wanting to admit. That it has certain subtleties to it that make more of us prone to it and fall prey to it than you might expect. And that's why it's worth giving an extended kind of consideration about what it means. This morning, we're going to look at a story from Israel's past. Why a story? Because as we've said from the beginning of the series, vices are merely sins that have become storylines of our life. They don't just appear. You don't suddenly develop a vice overnight. They are like, to use another meaning of the word vice, vices have to open and then they have to slowly close upon something until it has it in its grip. That's what a vice is. And therefore, one is not easily extricated from it. We're going to look at a story in Israel's history, but ironically, a story that makes absolutely no mention of the word gluttony. And I think, though, it will speak to the heart, or maybe to the belly, of what gluttony is, because it's far more subtle than you thought. And what we're going to learn from this story, in order to get our head around the idea of gluttony, we've got to learn three things. Something about hunger, something about delight, and something about glory. Something about hunger, something about delight, something about glory. We're going to be in Exodus chapter 16, the first 21 verses. Would you stand for a reading from Holy Word? Exodus chapter 16, starting in verse 1. They set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the people of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." And then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily." So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, "At evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against the Lord. For what are we that you grumble against us?" And Moses said, "When the Lord gives you in the evening meat to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your grumbling that you grumble against him, what are we? Your grumbling is not against us, but against the Lord." And then Moses said to Aaron, Say to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling. And as soon as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, I have heard the grumbling of the people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God. In the evening, quail came upon and covered the camp. And in the morning, dew lay around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine, flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they didn't know what it was. And Moses said to them, it's the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each one of you, as much as he can eat. You shall each take an omer according to the number of the persons that each of you has in his tent. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered, some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he could eat. And Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it over till the morning. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as he could eat. But when the sun grew hot, it melted. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. Let's talk about hunger. We're always in need of a little context because we're always coming at a text in the middle of a storyline. Here, Israel has just been liberated from a 400-year bondage in Egypt. It was a liberation by way of persuasion, at first by word, and then in plague, and finally by water. The story, though, is not just a liberation from bondage. It's liberation unto a land. A land that was promised long before they were taken captive. A land that was not meant simply for their own benefit. It was a land meant to be a base of operations by which they might be a benefit to the whole world. That's their gig. That's their calling. That's where they're headed. And as soon as they are clear to move on without hindrance in Exodus 14, they erupt in a song of praise to God. They are singing with jubilation, which makes what happens immediately after this all the more ironic and all the more sad. Because in chapter 15, the text just before our text, they can find no water. And so it says Israel begins to grumble against Moses and Aaron. And before you know it, Lord says to Moses, throw the log in the water. And he does. And the water turns sweet. And then Israel is all supplied with water. And as they lap it up, the Lord promises, you walk in my way, you will not be engaged in harm. You will not find harm. Here in our chapter, the complaint erupts again. It turns, though, from water to food, which is a little bizarre because in the next chapter, chapter 17, they're talking about finding enough grazing land for their sheep. So they're not totally without food. They've got food. It's traveling along behind them, making funny noises. But here in chapter 16, when it looks like food to them is going to be scarce, Israel's first response is to grumble. Their stomachs grumble. So their mouths grumble. But that word grumble in Hebrew is something a lot more than just being grumpy. It actually connotes a sign of rebellion. And so this grumbling of the mouth is really, if you will, more like a grumbling of the soul. It's deeper than just what's going on in the stomach. And you can see that in the content of their grumbling. Look there in verse 3 once more if you still have your Bibles open. Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you've brought us out into this wilderness to kill us with the whole assembly with hunger. They actually despise their deliverance. They long for their former enslavement where they had meat and bread. And they actually ascribe murderous, if not negligent, intent to Moses and Aaron for this moment. In other words, they're acting like children when they get hungry, right? You ever been around kids when they're hungry? You know. I have reflected upon this week that there may be no issue in my house that is more hotly debated and discussed than food. The whole framework for the idea of justice in my family centers around food. Like, injustice is all dependent upon whether everybody got an equitable amount of whatever was the highlight of that meal. It's it. It's all about food. And the panic we hear from Israel is so very similar to what you hear from children who don't know how to govern their bodily impulses. And yet, what is God's response to their petulance? He hears them and he feeds them. Four times in chapter 16, the text says, God hears their grumbling and acts to feed them. In inexplicable, if not miraculous ways, he feeds them quail at dusk, and he gives them this flaky sweet stuff that's kind of like coriander seed. They ended up calling it manna. It was their bread. He gives them that in the morning every day. They grumble, but God does not turn an exasperated eye. He feeds them. What does that response teach us? It teaches us the first thing we got to get if we're going to understand gluttony, and it's this. God is not indifferent to our hungers. He knows you're frail. He knows you are but dust. He knows that you might as well be dust without food. The first thing God does for humans after he fashions them is provides them food. But closer here to the context of our passage, why had Israel even journeyed to Egypt? Because they're out to escape a famine. To find food in the face of famine. When that famine strikes, God does not look at them and say, well, you know, it happens, right? Sorry, tighten your belt, get over it. He sends them to Egypt to feed them. I'm rereading the narrative about Joseph this week in Genesis 50. Why was Joseph permitted to go into slavery at the hands of his brothers? Was it to toughen Joseph up? Text does not say that. Was it to burden his father Jacob with guilt? The text certainly does not say that. But in Genesis 50, when Joseph says to his brothers, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good to bring it about that many people should be kept alive." You know what he's talking about? He's talking about God allowing a tragedy to befall Joseph so that Israel might be fed. God is not indifferent to our hungers. And the Old Testament confirms that. You know what? So does the New Testament. Jesus feeds the 4,000. Jesus feeds the 5,000. Why? Because he says, they're hungry. Give them something to eat. Most of Paul's letters address the issue of how Jews and Gentiles were going to live together in this new community of those by faith in Jesus. And what is the context most often referenced in that issue? Table fellowship. Eating together. Now, the food itself is not really at the center of that theological debate. We'll talk about food to idols. We'll talk about that later. That's not what's at the center. But the issue has implications for that context that brings the community together. And brothers and sisters, I don't need to tell you that eating together is a big way in which a community comes together and forms community. God is not indifferent to our hungers. Now, why do I need to say something like that, which is so patently obvious? It's almost not worth saying, you might think. I'll tell you why. Because gluttony is in part a belief that God doesn't care about feeding your hunger, and therefore you got to take matters into your own hands. That God is interested in the spiritual realm, but we're to take care of the physical realm, and never the twain shall meet. And so we give our bodies what our bodies seem to be asking for. Brothers and sisters, if you only let your bodily impulses determine your food choices, you have set yourself up for difficulty. And in the tradition of thinking about vices, gluttony is often paired with lust. Both vices have an object of their affection that the more one partakes of it, the more that affection for it grows. What C.S. Lewis said of sex could equally be said of food. He says, everyone knows that the sexual appetite, like our other appetites, grows by indulgence. So if the only thing influencing our eating is our belief that we are alone responsible for feeding ourselves, then we have set ourselves up for gluttony. Brothers and sisters, if God is not the God of our belly, then our belly becomes our God. And that's why there are ample texts that warn of what gluttony can lead to. I'm not going to rattle them off one in succession. Deuteronomy 21 talks about gluttony as a form of rebellion. Proverbs 28 talks about gluttony as a way of shame. Go read Ecclesiastes 6 sometimes, and it will say how the motivation for hunger is what motivates us most of our labor, and it's an insufficient motivation for our work. Proverbs 23 talks about how gluttony ends up impoverishing us. So the stance on letting our bellies be our God is fairly unequivocal when it comes to the text. But let me pause for a moment and let's be really clear here. With theological reflection on gluttony, it is necessary for us to recognize this. Gluttony is a lot more than just overeating. That's just one symptom of it. On the front of your bulletin is another excerpt from chapter 17 of the Screwtape Letters, where Screwtape mentions another expression of gluttony that you and I rarely think about. He says to another demon about some woman, he says, she is a positive terror to hostesses and servants. She is always turning from what has been offered her to say with a demure little sign and a smile, oh, please, please, all I want is a cup of tea, weak but not too weak, and the teeniest, weeniest bit of really crisp toast. You see, because what she wants is smaller and less costly than what has been set before her, she never recognizes as gluttony her determination to get what she wants, however troublesome it might be to others. The real value of quiet, unobtrusive work, which the devil has been doing for years on this old woman, can be gauged by the way in which her belly now dominates her whole life. The woman is in what we might be called the all-I-want state of mind. What's he talking about? In view here is not excessive eating in terms of quantity. It's all excessive in terms of pure preference. What's driving this person's demand for food has nothing to do with health, has nothing to do with the needs for others, has nothing to do with what she really needs. It's all about just what she wants. She's not thinking about God's interest for her hunger. And so she is taking it all into her own hands to the exclusion of all other concerns. That's as much gluttony as if she had asked for 6 buckets of fried chicken. But it's this concern for preference that gets us to the second thing that we need to understand if we're going to understand gluttony and how it's to be uprooted in us. We've seen that God feeds Israel, which means he's not indifferent to our hungers. But now we want to talk about what he feeds Israel with. Now here's where the sermon gets interactive. Ready? Ron, do you ever hunt quail? Yes. Does it taste better than chicken? Depends on how hungry you are, right? Right? You hunt quail, right? Yeah. All right. Now, let's take a straw poll. Do any of you like, at the end of a meal, from time to time, something sweet? Raise your hand. Yeah. Right? Okay. I'm not like talking about like a full-blown triple sundae. You know, a custard, a little piece of chocolate. Anybody dig that? I dig that too. Okay. Guess what? Despite Israel's cantankerousness, the Lord does not treat Israel like they're Oliver in the orphanage. The meal he gives is not gruel. It's quail at sunset. Quail! With a flaky sweet breakfast thing in the morning. It was an eat until you're full sort of deal. Just don't leave anything lying out because it's going to stink. What you keep will only fester. I mean, it is hard. There's a science to knowing how much food to buy, right? Because you don't want to make a trek to Costco every day, but you don't want to buy so much that 4 days from now it's starting to smell. So there's a science to it. God's thought of that. Only take what you need, and on Saturday or on Friday, get twice as much, and on Saturday, sit tight. It'll all be good. And so he feeds them till they're full. He feeds them with what nourishes, and he feeds them with what brightens them. What do we make of that? Not only is God not indifferent to our hungers, neither does he look down on the delight we find in satisfying those hungers. The Lord would seem not just to respect the delight we find in food, but to encourage us to find delight in it. Food to God is more than just a means to nourishment. Flavor, it seems, has a place in God's gastronomy. In Genesis 27, Isaac asks his son Jacob to prepare him not just a meal, but a delicious meal. And in that chapter alone, the word delicious shows up 6 times. When Jacob later sends out his sons to Egypt to get food, he tells them to bring to this man who, unbeknownst to them, is brother Joseph. He says, bring him the choice fruits. When Nehemiah is rebuilding the wall, rather than hoarding the allotment that would come from his Persian king, he instead sets before his leadership team every day choice sheep and birds. Choice! There would seem to be a premium on food that is good in the Old Testament. And you know what? The same is true in the New Testament. What is Jesus' first miracle? It's at a wedding, and he turns water into wine. But what is miraculous in itself is what the comment made by the steward of the feast, who says, everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now. The good wine. The stuff that's been sitting in the cellar since 1948. See, here's the deal. With all the perils associated with gluttony, and there are many, there is a tendency among the spiritual to overreact or to misinterpret the problem. And the Apostle Paul knew that because he writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy 4. He says this, now the Spirit expressly says that in later times, some will depart from the faith by devoting themselves to deceitful spirits and teachings of demons through the insincerity of liars whose consciences are seared, who forbid marriage and require abstinence from foods that God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. For everything created by God is good. Nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving, for it's made holy by the word of God and prayer. What's he saying? It's a seared conscience, Paul says, that looks suspiciously at food. It's a seared conscience that thinks of delighting in food as the express ticket to condemnation. Paul says, au contraire, food is from God. Food is to be received with thanksgiving to God. Delight is not diabolical, it's divine. Now, ordinarily, sermon needs illustration right here. Ordinarily, I would trot out for you that famous film, Babette's Feast. But I have overplayed that hand for a while with this community, so I'm going to go elsewhere. There's a film that came out several years ago that stars Juliette Binoche. Love that name. Sounds like a French pastry. It's the film Chocolat. And ironically, it takes place in a small French town during the season of Lent. And in that day, the way you observed Lent was that nobody ate chocolate. Like, that's the paragon of piety. No chocolate for you, right? The mayor of the town, who gives all the appearances of being deeply religious, he looks with contempt on anyone who breaks their little fast from chocolate. But Juliette Binoche happens to move into town right around Lent, and you know what her job is? She's a chocolatier. She opens up a store that makes chocolate, and she whips up these wonderful confections. And you can guess where the tension of the film goes, right? This woman who offers delight to people in a culture that believes that the way of true piety is all about forsaking delight, there's the tension. But the irony of it is that by the end of this film, this hard-bitten mayor is so angry with this chocolatier that he breaks into her establishment and ends up going on a maniacal gorging of all her food, such that the next morning she finds him with all the broken glass and him lying there in something equivalent to a stupor but with chocolate dripping down his chin. What does she do? Does she seize upon his hypocrisy? Does she lash out at his weakness? She offers him grace. And on that Sunday, the local priest goes impromptu with his homily. I've never done that before, so relax. And he says in his homily, or suggests that perhaps true spirituality is less a matter of what you deny than it is within what you embrace. That delight is in fact not diabolical, but it's divine. You heard in our confession of sin today a text that warns of gluttony, but it was juxtaposed against Isaiah's words, who said, "Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Listen diligently to me, eat what is good and delight yourselves in rich food." God is not dismissive of the delight to be found in food any more than he is indifferent to your hungers. But do you know why? Do you know why? Is it because he just doesn't want you to miss out on the delight of food? Like, is he somehow saying that the fullness of life is all about finding the delectableness of food? It's not. That's not the reason. He doesn't want you all to become, restaurant critics so that you can go to the French Quarter on somebody else's dime all the time. Why? Why is he not dismissive of delight? The reason we included Psalm 63 as the very first word you spoke today in your call to worship is this. I believe it is the key to understanding the delight of food without allowing food to become an end in itself. Listen again to that excerpt from Psalm 63 from the call to worship. My soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food, and my mouth will praise you with joyful lips when I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the watches of the night. He's making a comparison between the delight that can come with food and the knowledge of God. Which is to say, one important reason for why God does not dismiss our delight in food is because it is meant to become a pointer to our delight in Him. So far, it may sound like I've encouraged a lot of eating. But that totally misses the point. But that gets me to my last point. Amid the cacophony of Israel's grumbling about a scarcity of food, Moses said there to Aaron in verse 9, "Say to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he's heard your grumbling." And as soon as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, "I have heard the grumbling of the people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God." What's up with that? In the provision of food, and in the eating of the food, there is one thing he means for them to feed upon also. Even more so than the quail and the manna. They're meant to feed on the glory of God. In their eating, they're to be reminded that He is God. They're to recognize His glory among them. And so what does that tell us? Not just that God is not indifferent to our hungers. Not just that God is not dismissive of our delight. But thirdly, even in our eating, God means to be glorified. Even in our eating, God means to be glorified. Now, what does that rather lofty sentence mean? It means you have to apply a framework of faith to what you eat. It means giving thought to faith in looking for food to fill. It means if you detach food from faith, you'll never be full. What does it practically mean? I got three itty-bitty morsels here for you to close this out. Metaphorically speaking, double-check the recipe, say grace, and don't forget the main course. Double-check the recipe, say grace, don't forget the main course. Here we go. Double-check the recipe. When you have kids in your house that are learning how to cook, you witness a lot of enthusiasm about recipes, and about measuring cups and all that. And yet in their enthusiasm, you will sometimes hear requests like, "Can I make brownies?" And you say, "Honey, it's 8 a.m. love the enthusiasm, maybe later. This moment doesn't call for that food. That recipe doesn't call for this need, but thanks. What I mean by double checking is this. Go to food for what food is for, but not for what it's not. When Jesus is in the wilderness, fasting at the beginning of his ministry, and he's tempted by Satan to turn the stones into bread, what does he say? Man shall not live by bread alone. I.e., no physical food truly fills. No culinary consumption provides a comprehensive contentment. Looking for fullness of life in food, it will always be a dead end. And so, yes, we do look to food for nourishment. Yes, we do look to food for strength and even for delight. So we look to food for what food is meant to do. But brothers and sisters, we go to God for what food can't do and what it's not supposed to do. Frederick Buechner, on the front of your bulletin, offers what I think is the clearest and most vivid definition of gluttony. He says this, a glutton is one who raids the icebox for a cure of spiritual malnutrition. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. He's talking about yours and my tendency to let food and drink be a counselor to us, to be an ultimate source of comfort to us, even though we know deep down in our bellies that it never could be. Glorifying God in our eating means refusing to look for a palliative in food when there is a remedy in God. Which means you have to regularly ask yourself, what are you going to that food and drink for? Are you lonely? Are you angry? Are you bitter? In any of those moments, food and drink will help for about 4 hours. And then you're going to wake the next day with the same hollowness. And while that large meal or sweet confection may curb the deeper pang for a while, it will never heal it. And in turn, you have only treated your body with a certain measure of contempt by making it do what it cannot, by outsourcing your spiritual problem to a physical remedy. Brothers and sisters, some of your food is killing you. Or it's at least robbing you of years. And it's because you're not asking yourself, why am I going to food and drink? When eating, you have to ask why. You got to double check the recipe. Secondly, you got to say grace. Now look, I know, at least in this civilization, in this culture, like no time in human history has it been so easy to get food. You don't think about it. And so giving thanks for food before a meal, my family does it. Sometimes it feels like this is just kind of what we do, right? It's the rote thing. It's sometimes even lifeless. Look, true disciplined gratitude is its own deterrent against using a gift in an unintended and distorted way. Thankfulness, true thankfulness to the giver, is what keeps me from trying to take more from him than he wishes me to have. If you can look somebody in the eye that's giving you a gift and receive that gift, but to try to take something from their back pocket at the same time, you're a better person than me. If you can look somebody in the eye and take a gift from them that you then end up using in a distorted way, that's a seared conscience. Garrett Kaiser, in a very different format, said this about Thanksgiving. He said, if there is anything we enjoy for which we cannot give heartfelt thanks, it means we are either heretics or thieves. We must either change our theology or relinquish our delights. Anytime you eat, you ought to really stop and realize, without this, you're dead. And whatever delight you might get from it is a gift. That's not promised. Give thanks to God for your food so that you don't use your food as a substitute for God. Thirdly, double check the recipe, say grace, and then don't forget the main course. Look, you can ask at every meal, why am I eating? You can say at every meal, Lord, you are very kind to give me this thing that will not only help me live, but allow me to enjoy something. You can do that every time. It will not root out or preempt the move toward gluttony. What will? what has to shape all your eating is by eating him who is the bread of life. When Jesus feeds the multitudes and then calls out those who are only following him because they thought that he was their meal ticket, he says to them, don't work for food that spoils, but for food that endures to eternal life. He is saying, those of you who think that real life is all about having a full stomach, it isn't. And even those with full stomachs will tell you as much. Instead, Jesus is saying that there is a kind of food, there is a kind of sustenance in knowing that you are known and that you are loved anyway. There is a contentment that has nothing to do with caloric intake. And it's a contentment derived from knowing that though you were yet sinners, Christ died for you. That though you may have sought to find your peace and tranquility in food, Christ died for you so that you might find it in him. That though you might have mistreated the temple of God with what you have chosen to feed it, that Christ died for you that you might use that temple for him. He's saying that there is a sustenance to be had in knowing that, and that sustenance is found in him who is the bread, and you must feed on him. You must study and contemplate what he has said. You must turn those reflections into words that we call prayer, and you must come to this table. Because it's at this table that he reminds us all that God is not indifferent to our hungers. He is not dismissive of our delight. But that even if we should be in lack, there is a contentment to be had in knowing that we are his. And it's that contentment that allows you to walk with contentment even when you're hungry. Let me close with a line from the Apostle Paul, who could not have put it more bluntly, when he says to the church at Corinth, "If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." He's saying this: if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then eat however you like, man. Eat however you like. Eat to get the most out of this life, this momentary life, which, by the way, gluttony will not do that for you. It will rob you of years. But he's saying if there was a resurrection, then eat and drink with a view to a later moment, to a later meal, to a marriage supper of the Lamb. And then you will eat with delight. Then you will eat with gratitude. And then you will eat with that restraint that we need. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.